Seems like interest in using native plants in home gardens just continues to grow, and it's no surprise since we have a lot of good qualities to recommend them. And with last summer's drought conditions, we were able to see how they do in those extreme conditions. Some did great, some not so great. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Neil DeBoll from Prairie Nursery comes by a few times a year to talk with us about how to use native plants and why you should appreciate them. Neil, always great to have you with us.
Always great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
And you know that drought last year, that was a tough
It's the
drought.
Worst drought I've seen in my 59 years on the planet.
Yeah, it was bad. And it affected a lot of plants.
Oh, my goodness, yes. It affected a lot of trees, a lot of shrubs.
Yeah.
Interestingly, one of the trees that was really, really hit by it was the box elder, which is one of my least favorite trees. Kind of a weedy tree. And some of our conifers really took a hit, too. But most of the prairie plants came through in shining colors. There were a few that were surprisingly did experience some difficulties, but the vast majority of them came through. And there's a lot of reasons for that. A lot of them have...
Yeah, why?
First of all, they grew up here. And they're used to this brutal weather. And, of course, they have to deal with 40, 50 below zero. Well, it used to be that cold, but really cold. And as well as temperatures over 100, 110. So some of the adaptations are deep roots. Some of these plants have roots that are 10, mm-hmm. 15, maybe even 20 feet deep, depending on the soil type. And then you have their leaf structures. Some of these plants have waxy leaves that prevent the loss of moisture. Others have hairy leaves that create what they call a boundary layer, where air, when the wind blows, the hairs keep a layer of non-active or lower speed air, so they lose less moisture through their leaves. Some have highly reflective leaves, so the temperature doesn't build up on the leaf.
Interesting.
There's all kinds of interesting adaptations. Some of them just wilt temporarily. So when it gets hot in the afternoon, their leaves and their flowers will wilt so that there's minimal moisture loss. Then overnight, they recharge moisture from the soil, and in the morning, they're ready to go again. So they got a good deal. You only have to work like half a day.
Neil DeBoll, our guest today here on the Ideas Network, talking about, of course, about healthy and beautiful native gardens, meadows, and prairies with him. And, you know, every one of our phone lines is... already filled up.
Well, it's a slow day out there, Larry. Yes.
Arlene in New Berlin, for example, is with us. Hi, Arlene.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I do have your catalog, and I find it very interesting. The two questions I want, first is, I have a hill on the southwest side of my property, and we have 6 evergreens and a couple of lilies scattered throughout it. And my husband tried to put a mulch down, and of course it ran down the hill. So now I have a lovely bunch of weeds.
Mm-hmm.
And so I am wondering if it would be good to plant either no-mow grass or your Pennsylvania sedge. And the second question is there anybody in the county of Waukesha landscaping that does that? Because I think I'm going to have somebody come out and do it landscaping, because I'm going to be 73, and I just can't do it anymore.
Yeah.
And I'll take my answer off the air.
Well, actually, don't go away. I have a couple questions.
Okay.
I have a couple questions for you.
Okay.
Okay. What is your soil type?
It's clay.
It's clay. It faces southwest.
Yes.
Okay. And how steep?
And in fact, this morning it's getting the brightest sun you ever want to see.
Okay. Let me just stay on the line here a little bit, because I want to make sure if there are any other questions that you can answer those to make sure we really get your question answered properly. Our no-mow lawn mix, which is composed of 6 different fine fescue grasses, is really not adapted for heavy clay soils. And the reason is it has very deep roots and it has difficulty penetrating into heavy clays, thus removing its advantage of its deep rooting nature, which gives it its drought tolerance.
Uh-huh.
And also, it's a cool season grass. Cool season grasses do not do well in extremely hot conditions, generally speaking, and a southwest-facing slope is the hottest microclimate you can conjure up, because it gets the hottest, mm-hmm. driest sun and wind from the west, making it a very difficult site. Mm. If you're going to put something there, that's a perfect place for prairie. Because by picking plants, prairie plants that will grow in the clay, and I'm sure you noticed in our catalog, you have, there's a clay buster section, plants that are adapted to clay. Now, you got to make sure that your management is going to match what your garden design is. And obviously, if you put prairie plants on that hill next to your evergreens, you are not going to be managing it by burning.
Or,
or you'll end up with a prairie and nice little brown sticks of evergreens, which was probably not your original intent.
No.
Okay. So then you have to make sure that your management, if it's a garden, it's not a big deal. In a garden situation, you can just cut everything down with a weed whacker.
Mow it.
Yeah, mow it in the spring and you're good to go. So make sure, and when I design landscapes, I make sure that I look at the maintenance protocols first. And everything is driven by how I'm going to take care of that landscape, because what we're doing here is we're creating low-maintenance landscapes, and the only way to truly create a low-maintenance landscape is to make sure that you've got your maintenance plan figured out from the start.
That's why I like lasagna gardening. I wish I had started that first.
Well, maybe that's something you could do on your hillside, you know, but stake that lasagna down so it doesn't all end up at the bottom of the oven.
Thanks,
Now, is there anybody in Waukesha that does that kind of landscaping?
Yes, there are more and more landscapers that are learning how to do this. We also provide landscaping consultation and design and installation services. Sometimes people like to work locally. We go all over the state. We go in Illinois. But if you want somebody locally, I tell you what, you can call me at the office, and I can maybe get you some contacts. I'll be back in the office later this afternoon.
And that's 608-296-2741.
No, that's our fax number. Let me give you the 800 number. And anybody that wants to get a catalog can call this as well. It's 800-476-9453, which stands for 1-800-GROW-WILD.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. I greatly appreciate it.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And your catalog, your new catalog, it's pretty nice, as always.
Thank you. Yeah,
I love the color photography in there, because you really get to see what these plants are going to look like.
Yep, that's really, really important. You know, Larry, it's funny. I did for the first time ever, I did a lecture in Atlanta a few weeks ago about the native plant industry, past, present, and future. And I did a retrospective of our catalog all the way back to 1982 when I first started doing this. And it was so funny to look at it. And, you know, we didn't have any color in our catalog until, I believe it was the fall of 1986. And, you know, we were making no money trying to sell weeds. Okay, remember, these are all weeds. Okay? Once we put color in the catalog, our sales instantly doubled.
Oh, just like that.
Just like that. And a couple years later, I was able to move out of my trailer and get a house.
Good. John, man, you've been going great ever since. John and Madison, hello. Thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm pretty excited. I've got a little bit of family land up in northern Wisconsin, and we've got ticks and mosquitoes, and I'm just wondering what plants I can put down to help reduce those levels. Right now, it's just about a 2-acre lawn that we mow when we get up there, maybe a week before we go up if we spend time to try to reduce the ticks. But I know there's like a purple flowering wild plant that can reduce ticks. And then,
well, I'm not an arachnid expert, but I do know that where I find the highest level of ticks is usually in shrublands, where you have a lot of shrubs, young trees. But grasslands also they are home for all kinds of organisms, including ticks. So I don't know of any magic plants that are going to make the ticks go away as a repellent. Now, maybe somebody out there knows that, but I'm not aware of that. And I find, actually, I get much fewer ticks on my property when I work in my prairie compared to when I work in my woods.
You have a lot fewer.
Yes, I get a lot more ticks in the woods. This is just my own personal experience. And I'll be working in the woods, and I might pull off 3-4 deer ticks every night when I'm working in the woods. And when I'm in the prairie, I very seldom have to deal with that. So that's just my personal experience. But I'd say get rid of that lawn and plant a prairie, be done with it. But this was just one idea, of course. You know what a lot of people do also on their recreational land is they plant our no-mow lawn mix, as we were talking about earlier, because it doesn't require fertilizing, especially if you're near a lake. And you don't have to worry about water pollution, and you have to mow it much less frequently than a more traditional lawn. But as far as making the ticks go away, I just don't know what would do that. Do you know anything, Larry?
I can't. I mean, you're exactly right, though, about the conditions. I mean, in a wooded area, you're going to get a lot more problems with the ticks, for sure.
All right. Yeah, it is surrounded by woods, but the no-mow lawn, like, if you wanted to replace the regular grass that we had with no-mow lawn, is that a fairly intensive process, or is there just a seed we can put down on top of it? Is this rocky soil?
You would have to eliminate all the existing vegetation in order to do it right, and the best time to plant your no-mow lawn, as with any cool season turf, is in September in Wisconsin. So what some people do is they kill the existing lawn, weeds, et cetera, off all year. If it's okay for you to use Roundup just as a preparation process, we usually spray it like 3 times every 2 months to kill everything off, and then you can go in the fall and you can just scatter the seed on top of the dead turf in September, and with normal fall rains, it will usually germinate and do fine. However, if you don't want to use Roundup, you can smother it. That would not work on 2 acres, probably. That would be difficult. Some people will till the soil repeatedly every 3 weeks or so, but man, that's a big job. And if you're on a hillside tilling the soil, that just doesn't work because then you have erosion issues. So, but you do have
it's pretty flat.
Okay, that's good. What's your soil type?
The soil type, I'm pretty sure it's just like rocky, mostly dirt, just dark soil, but with a couple of just pebbles and rocks in it.
Okay.
Water table's pretty high.
Okay. Is the soil wet there or damp regularly?
It's hard for me to tell. It's a little bit north of Krivitz, so it's pretty far north, but there's a river behind in the forested part of the property, but it's fairly damp, I think.
Okay, if it's really a wet soil, I would not recommend our no-mow because it doesn't like wet feet. It does best, and this is where a lot of people up north find it to be a godsend, it does really well on dry, sandy, and rocky soil, and it is extremely shade-tolerant as long as you rake the leaves off in the fall so it does not smother the turf. But
yeah, there's mostly conifers around.
Yeah, that's okay.
Yeah.
But and I've grown it under my pines. I grow it in my woods as trails, under my oaks and hickories. I use it as trails.
Oh,
and
that'd be amazing.
And it's on pure rock. I mean, I'm on dolomite. It's like 85% rock and 15% soil. I take a pickaxe to prepare my planting. And I just put that seed down in September, and I walk across the trail to stamp it into the ground, and it comes up that fall, and I rake the leaves off once a year, and it has been there for 10, 15 years, depending on the trail. It works great.
Yeah.
Works great.
Works
great.
Awesome. Good luck, John.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it very much. Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Our guest, I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears Poisson, our producer on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking healthy and beautiful native gardens and meadows and prairies today with our guest, Neil DeBoe, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. Great to have him along. Thank you so much for listening in. I really appreciate it. Neil, we started to talk a little bit about plants that and the drought and got away from it a bit. Maybe we should go back to that and talk about some of the specific plants that did or didn't do well.
You know, Larry, it was a very instructional year. And you look at the terrible, terrible weather we had, and it hurt us as far as seed production. Of course, all our plants we grow in greenhouses, and it's completely controlled, and we have great, great plants. But we had a significantly reduced seed production because the plant's natural response is to reduce flowering and seed production. But what's really interesting, I didn't water any of my prairies because I wanted to see their response. I could have stuck sprinklers out there and made sure everything was copacetic. And I have done that in the past. And one good overnight watering usually will last you for, you know, 2 or 3 weeks of killer weather and everything looks fine. But I said, I'm not watering anything this year. I'm going to see what the plants do. And there were a few surprises. Almost all of the taprooted plants, like butterfly weed, lead plant, the white false indigo, the cream false indigo, the pale purple coneflower, the purple prairie clover, wild petunia, compass plant, prairie dock, these guys never skipped a beat.
Yeah.
They just kept going and going and going. It's like, where's the drought? Nobody told us about the drought. Although, for the first time ever, I did see butterfly weed wilt. I'd never seen it wilt, even in the drought of 1988 and the drought of 1976, which are the two biggest droughts I've seen in my life. What also was interesting, there were plants that don't have deep tap roots. They also were essentially, apparently, unaffected.
Wow. Now,
it was really, really a shocker. Some of the plants I thought would really be hammered just never got bothered. And an interesting thing, and you see this quite often, and we saw this in 1988, some plants, for instance, the nodding pink onion, which grows generally in kind of moist areas. I have it growing right in my rocky prairie in my front yard. It just sat there and sat there. It has very waxy leaves. It never turned, nothing turned brown. It just sat there, and it normally blooms in July. It didn't bloom in July.
Nah.
And it rained in August, and the thing bloomed. And it's, and plants, they defer their blooming until there's moisture. They're smart. They know. They didn't just show up yesterday, you know. And Rattlesnake Master, it has very waxy leaves, never skipped a beat. The asters and goldenrods, most of those were fine. The stiff goldenrod, surprisingly, which grows on very dry sandy soils as well as heavy clay soils, did get... It got
hammered?
Stunted. Yeah, not hammered, but it was stunted. Yeah. But the showy goldenrod, which grows on the driest of dry prairies and dry, dry sand, never... I mean, the tips of the leaves didn't brown. It bloomed profusely. And I looked out in these prairies where little bluestem, which is a very dry species, it was losing half of its leaves, turning brown.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. Big bluestem. I'd never seen big bluestem do this. And there were plants on our dry sand. If you're on good, you're on clay soil, it has more moisture, these grasses were better. On the dry sand, the big bluestem, there were plants with 50, 60, 70% of their leaves turned brown by July.
Wow.
A showy goldenrod is just there. It's just all these old fields just full of showy goldenrod. Like, it was the boss. It was so amazing. And the sunflowers, which also typically have hairy leaves, and they reflect the sun, and they also have that boundary layer that prevents moisture loss. They just kept going, like, what's the big deal, guys? Come on, bring it on.
And showy goldenrod.
Yeah, it was amazingly drought tolerant. I never would have imagined it. And even some of our moist-loving plants, wet prairie plants, like the red milkweed or marsh milkweed, it was a little shorter than usual, but it did its thing. And fox sedge, which grows at the edge of marshes, it's just like, hey, we're doing fine. We even have it planted in upland sand in our display gardens. It just kept going and going and going and going. So, you know, some of these plants, they forget to read the book, and they don't know they're supposed to act that way. I was really impressed, for the most part, with the resilience of these plants.
Email from Max in Racine. You mentioned goldenrod. That's why I thought I'd bring this up right now. He was just wondering what kind of spring maintenance needs to be done on his compass plant and goldenrod. Also, how fast do these spread? He loves your nursery, by the way.
Oh, great. Thank you. Generally speaking, and I'm assuming that he can't burn. Does he say anything there about burning?
No.
Okay. Obviously, burning is kind of our magic bullet for controlling cool season weeds and grasses in the prairie. But unless he has a small garden, all you really have to do is go and take a weed whacker or a scythe. If you like to do it the old-fashioned way like I do, I go out with a scythe and swing that thing back and forth and just cut everything down and rake it off to expose the soil to allow the soil to warm up. If you have some weeds that have invaded the area, you may have to deal with them, and your treatment for that varies widely depending upon whether it's a perennial or an annual. You may want to – some people like to mulch their gardens. I'm not a big mulcher. I like to plant the plants really close together so the plants kind of do the work for you.
Yep.
And my compass plant has a deep taproot. I surround that with prairie grasses or fibrous-rooted flowers. In our catalog, we now list the root types so people can use that for designing their gardens.
Oh.
So you make the plants do the work for you by associating the taproots with the fibrous roots, completely surrounding the soil surface, so weeds have a less of a chance to get in there. So that's really important, really important. But just cut everything down. When to do it? Generally speaking, about mid-April, most of your plants, well, in a normal year.
Yeah. I wonder if the snow will be gone.
Yeah, probably about June 1st, you know. But as soon as the plants start to come up, you can just basically cut everything down, rake it off. If you have any weed problems, then you have to have a strategy for controlling those as well.
Bob in Elroy, thank you for calling. Hello.
Yes, in a few weeks, I will be receiving from Prairie Nursery some obedient plant, cardinal flower, blue lobelia, royal catch flower, fly, and... Would there be any advantage or disadvantage to putting a slow-release Osmocote-type fertilizer in the soil as I plant them?
Let me ask you a couple questions, Bob. I assume you have some damp areas and then some more upland areas for your plants. Is that correct? Or are you just putting them in a garden?
It's just a garden, sandy loam. I have no problem with the moisture. I water rainwater system, and so I've used water-loving species and dry species right all in the same area with careful care. In fact, I ordered those same plants last year, and despite the drought, they all did well by care and watering.
Sure.
And so I want to add some more to them. And I just wondered if the Osmocote would help them
things
along,
along,
help them catch up with last year's plant.
Sure. Well, you know, it's a beautiful thing you've got there, sandy loam, because you can grow almost anything if you want a moisture plant. Just add water, and because it's a sandy loam, it has good drainage. So the plants that don't like a lot of moisture are going to be just fine. So that's a great situation. You typically, and one of the reasons one of the main reasons we plant native plants is because they don't generally require fertilizer unless they're on extremely, extremely poor soils. But it sounds like you have nice soil. You could add fertilizer, but these plants will respond to it, definitely. But go easy on it because you don't need that much, but you can certainly do it. And an Osmocote is great because it is slow release.
So there you go.
Thank you.
Good luck, Bob. Thank you for calling. Paul in Grafton. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, thank you for taking the call. Good morning. I am on the board of directors of a local about eight acre fenced-in public dog park here in Grafton. And because of recent increases in use, we, at the end of the year last year, with about a two-acre section in the middle of the park that is just mud with a few weeds thrown in with the mud. Obviously, we need to deal with that. I was curious about your no-mow grass mix, if that would be appropriate for heavy use for something like a dog park. And the other problem we have with that is we can't wait till fall. We've got to deal with this spring.
Sure. Okay.
It's muddy. That's not a good sign for the no-mow, is it?
Well, unless it's temporary mud, but yeah. Paul, is it a moist, low-lying area that gets a lot of moisture?
No, actually, it would be great for grass. It's, I would say, northeast-facing slope, so it drains very well. It's just muddy because right now there's just nothing to absorb the moisture.
Well, you've got everything going for you except the fact that our no-mow lawn mix is only a medium-use turf. It is not going to take the kind of abuse that you probably are going to get on a site like that. We drive our tractors in our fields on it. We have it between our rows. Cars, trucks, tractors go on there. But if you're going to have really, really hard use, like for athletic purposes or constant heavy dog use, you're probably going to want to look at something like a Madison Parks mix where you've got a good proportion of bluegrass. Bluegrass is one of your toughest turfs. And put some perennial rye in there to get it started and... look at that mix. That's a really, really good mix, or any athletic mix, because you can plant cool season grasses such as our no-mow or any of these other turf mixes in April. But the problem is that you will get a higher weed densities because most of your weeds germinate in spring.
And right.
The beauty of planting in fall is that very few weeds germinate in fall. So your turf gets started with little competition. But no problem. You'll get good germination. You'll just have to mow it more regularly. But I would not recommend our no-mow mix for heavy use areas because it really only has a medium tolerance for wear.
Okay.
So get yourself a good athletic.
One of the things we don't like doing is mowing, for one thing, just because of time.
Yes.
And because it's such a big area. And from what I have seen looking around, I haven't found a no-mow athletic mix.
I know of no such thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. 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 You're gonna have to bite the bullet one way or the other here. Now, you know what you could do, Paul? You could do a test. You could do 1 acre in an athletic mix and do 1 acre in our no-mow. And if your activity is not so dense that you get a lot of wear and tear, the no-mow might be just fine for you. But I don't want to recommend something that might not work for you.
Okay.
Does that make sense as far as giving a test? But really, if you're going to have heavy wear, you're going to have to go with a more traditional athletic mix.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Paul. Got an email from Carrie, who loves Prairie Nursery, but says, I've noticed that most of your woodland plants are for acidic soil. Any suggestions for alkaline clay shade plants? I've got a small dry woods that needs some ground plants.
Well, you know, actually, do we say that they're mostly for acidic soils?
I don't
think so. Now, a common misconception is that most woodland plants need acidic soil, and you'll find this in books. And I think that's because most of these books are written in the East, where the soils tend to be of granitic origin or gneiss or schist, and those are acidic soils. And there are some that indeed do require acidic soils, like Tiarella, the foam flower. I cannot grow that at my house. I have dolomite. It's pH 7.3 to 7.6, and I put Tiarella in there, and it's gone in a year. Okay?
Yeah.
But I'm able to, if you look at everything in our catalog, I grow every single one of these plants except the Tiarella in my pH 7.3 to 7.6. So, and some of these wooden plants can go as high as close to 8. So, that would not be a problem for you. You should be in good shape. I think one of the things is that we do mention when plants are particularly acid tolerant. Some of these plants can tolerate extremely acid soils, and not oftentimes we will note that.
Neil DeBoe, our guest today, and we have, finally have some open lines, so you can join in at 1-800-642-1234. Give us a call with your questions as we talk with him about prairies, gardens, meadows. Neil DeBoe, our guest, and the number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Dennis in Deerfield. Hi, Dennis.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I tell you what, last year I called you about the same thing, and I'm wondering, are you getting any closer to finishing your book?
The book project from hell. Yes, Dennis, progress is occurring. I met with my co-author. We have our annual January 2 weeks of sequestration in front of a computer screen, and of about 1,000 photos going in the book, we thought we had them all, but we are short by about 40, which we will have to complete this year. And we expect to fully, there is no choice. We will get this done, and we're submitting the text to the publisher in a month or so. And so really at this point, we just have a few tables, a few seed mixes, and a few photographs to finish. If we can finish that by the end of 2013, then it goes to the publisher, and they do whatever they do and torture us a little bit more, and then eventually it will be published shortly before my death.
Well, hopefully it's not before my death, after my death. See, I have one other related thing. I wonder if you might have a recommendation of a book that deals more specifically with native shrubs.
There are all kinds of books out there. Are you talking about identifying the shrubs?
Well, both identifying and propagation and so on. And most of them, I've got several different shrub books.
Yeah.
And they tend to have some natives, but they tend to really be a lot of exotics.
Yes, indeed.
Which is fine. You know, I'm not totally against exotics, but I was wondering if there wasn't someone who dealt more directly with native shrubbery and the propagation and the requirements and so on.
You know, that's an outstanding question, and there may be such a book out there, but I haven't found it. Now, I use a lot of native book guides, but they're mostly identification guides, and they don't give you the kind of propagation information that you're looking
for. That's the thing I find missing, too. The propagation books and landscaping books, you know, they'll have a handful of natives, and then they'll have all kinds of exotics, and without knowing which ones are which, sometimes it's a little hard to sort it out.
It is. You know what? You bring up a really, really good point there, Dennis.
Well, that's your next book, then, I guess.
Well, let me tell you. That's what they're... Okay, when the prairie book is done, the publisher already wants us to do the woodland book, and then they want us to do the freaking shrub book. It's like, can we just get this done here?
Let's get this one done first?
Yes, and in our book, we do list all the methods of propagation of the native prairie species, either from seed, division, cuttings, root divisions, whatever. All that will be listed in the book.
Well, that'll be great. I guess I got to look for that in 2014 then.
I hope by then, man. I'm telling you, this is it's blossomed into far more than we ever anticipated.
We will definitely be discussing it on this show,
whether we like it or not.
Okay, I'll call back in about 6 months.
No, give me a year, Dennis.
But I just got to keep pushing you.
Oh, don't worry. That's happening, man. That's happening.
Thanks, Dennis. Thanks a lot for calling. All right. Jeff in Dorchester, Iowa. Hi, thank you for calling.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for the show. I have picked up about 6 ounces of wild garlic cloves. Got them last fall, and they've been sitting open air in our kitchen in a cookie sheet. Can I just broadcast those this spring in an open yard setting and take my chances?
Yes, you can. What I would do is I would go out there when the soil is it. When you say open yard, are you talking about open soil? Is there lawn? What's growing there?
Well, there is lawn, but I could turn it if necessary.
Well, the best way to do this, those are actually asexual propagules, and you really want to get them into the soil if you can. It's like bulb. It's just like planting a bulb.
Yeah.
You don't have to plant it 4 inches deep like a tulip, but you want to get it down in the soil. So what you can do with those, if the soil is damp and you have exposed soil, you can just go and drop one here and there and just push them into the soil with your foot. This time of year is the perfect time to do it once the snow is gone and the soil is damp. They don't need a lot of help because, well, for a lot of people, That's a weed.
Yeah.
And that was a huge weed for dairy farmers because it would taint their milk. And now you have, you know, all you could do with it was make onion cheese out of it. So, but yeah, I mean, it's a great native plant. But the best way to do it is to get those little bulbs down into the soil if you possibly can. If they sit on the surface of the soil, your success rate will be greatly diminished.
Okay, and you call them asexual propagules?
Yeah, yeah, they're not actually, those are not seeds. They were little heads that you pulled the bulbs off of, right? Yeah, yeah, they just make little bulbs.
Is that something I should keep away from the grandkids?
No. unless your grandkids are vampires.
Oh, okay. Well, then, yeah, there's no problem there. Werewolfism might be a problem.
Okay. Right. Okay, good luck.
Thanks, Jeff. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Say, you know, I wanted to bring this up because you and I talked about it before the program. There's we're talking about gardenings. There's a memory garden in Oak Creek, and I think that's a great story, fascinating story. And tell us about that.
Yeah, I got a call from a guidance counselor at the Oak Creek High School late last summer, and he and his team at the school asked me if I would design a memorial garden for the remembrance of the people killed at the Sick Temple in Oak Creek. Hmm. And I designed a garden, and it's three different pieces at the high school, right at the entrance to the high school. And we installed the first section of it last fall in September. And we're going to put in the next two sections this spring on Saturday, May the 4th. And I will tell you, it was an extremely moving experience there last fall. People from the Sick community were there, people from the high school. It was a really nice ceremony. People read poetry and stories. And there we were planting this memorial garden with four generations of people from the Sick community, from the Oak Creek community, from little kids to great-grandmas. It was a really special moment. And so, and really, the concept, and I have to give all the credit to the folks at Oak Creek High School because they came up with this. The prairie garden symbolizes the diversity of all these different plants that coexist and grow in a community. And that's exactly what we're evoking with people, as all different types of people getting along. We all have our own characteristics and our own ways, but we're all people and we all belong to the same community. And it's really a special experience. So next Saturday, May 4th at 11 o'clock, we'll be installing the plants, and the kids will be there, and members of the community.
So anybody's invited.
Everybody's invited. Absolutely.
That's wonderful.
So that's you can find out more. I think if you just Google Oak Creek High School, you should be able to find directions there. It's on the south side of Milwaukee.
Yep.
It's really easy to get to.
Tom and Stoddard, turning to you now. Thanks for calling.
Yes, good morning. I heard you discussing before about Osmocote, and I've always avoided it because I suspicion that it was little bits of fertilizer that are coated in plastic, and I didn't want to put that in my soil, and I would think would be absolutely the antithesis of organic gardening, even though they can argue that plastics are made out of minute particles and are going to break down. I understand that microscopically those plastic particles are so large compared to microorganisms that they're not going to be able to deal with it at all. Thank you.
Mm.
You know, I never use Osmocote. I don't even know what's in that stuff. I just know it's some kind of fertilizer. But no, it's commonly used. That doesn't mean it's good, but...
But it is commonly used.
Yeah, it's very commonly used. I don't really...
You don't use it?
No, I never use it. No, it's very commonly used in the nursery industry, but because we grow native plants, we do fertilize our plants in our production facilities, in our greenhouses, because we want to grow them big and get a crop turned around. But, I mean, once put it in a pot, I mean, you don't need to... Yeah. Force it with all these fertilizers. It's kind of a waste, really.
Jim emailed us, last summer's drought left our septic mound grass dead. What would your recommendation be for reestablishing vegetation on the mound? I raked in grass seed last fall, hoping it might take this spring. I'm not confident it will take. Located in Dodge County, overlooking Horicon Marsh, on a west-facing drumlin, can a no-mow grass work on this location? And if so, how would one get started? I'm sorry, he actually put the seed in.
Well, your seed is probably going to come up this spring. I can almost guarantee you that because you can plant cool season grasses in the fall as a dormant seeding, and they typically will come up just fine in the spring. So you're probably going to get what you planted. What to plant there really depends upon a lot of factors. Was that, again, a septic system or a mound system, Larry?
Let's see. I'm going to check this again. He says a mound, septic mound.
Okay. Most septic mounds, in fact, I believe all septic mounds in the state of Wisconsin, they are required to put a certain layer of topsoil over it. So the topsoil and the nature of that topsoil will determine what you can establish there. For instance, if it's really gooey, heavy clay with very little organic matter, that's a terrible place for the no-mow grass. Okay? That's something where you can plant a more clay-tolerant turf like bluegrass perennial rye. However, if you want something more interesting than just grass, you can plant a prairie on it. And in fact, University of Wisconsin Extension has a pamphlet that you can get online that tells you exactly how to establish native prairie vegetation on your mound system. And it's very beneficial because it helps to take the moisture out of it. It creates habitat.
Yeah,
and it's way more interesting than a boring lawn.
Looks a lot better. And then you're not sitting out there mowing at all.
Oh, yeah. And mowing up and down those hills? Yeah, it's way more fun to burn it. Make sure, if you've got any of those little plastic little vents, cover those vents with a bucket, with a steel bucket or something. Don't burn your plastic vents.
Okay. Jan in French Island. Hi, Jan.
Hi.
Where's French Island?
Are you familiar with La Crosse?
Oh, sure.
Right in Mississippi.
It's west of the mainland. Okay.
Of course. All right.
Okay. We have... false indigo blue bush. When does it bloom? I mean, I've had it for like 3 years. Our soil is sandy, but does it ever bloom?
Okay, let me ask you a few questions. Okay,
yeah.
Did you install it as a transplant?
Or? It was a small plant.
Okay, and it was 3 years ago?
Yes.
Okay, it can take up to 5 years for the blue, the white, or the cream indigo to reach maturity and bloom.
Okay.
Plus, you're on that French Island sand, which typically has a lower nutrient status than like a nice loam or clay loam or sandy loam. So the plants are going to typically grow more slowly.
Okay.
So whereas somebody on a higher quality soil that may bloom in 4 years, it might take 6 years.
Okay.
Okay. These plants, you know, this is like a retirement plan, putting in these guys. But, I mean, really, if you look at it, some of these prairie plants can live, we know some of them live 70 years. I mean, some of them are like trees. I've planted some indigos 35 years ago when I first started doing this, and those plants are still going strong. I have no idea how long those things live.
That's wonderful.
It's amazing. I mean, I swear some of these live longer than some of your short-lived trees.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I would say give it 5 years and see if you don't start to see some blooms by then, Jan.
Okay. One other question.
Yep.
You had mentioned the Osmocote, that you weren't familiar with it. There's another one that's supposed to be organically safe.
Oh.
It's Monrovia or something, but it is, I think, one of the people from the university that gives talks.
At University of Wisconsin?
Yes.
Oh, wonderful. I'm sure somebody must know about this then specifically. Yeah, we should find that out.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Johnson was, I think she or the woman right before her always talked about it, and I think had an interest in it. So.
Oh, great. Yeah, since we don't use a lot of fertilizers because we don't need to, I'm woefully ignorant of all these fertilizers.
So, okay. All right. Yeah. Thank you.
But thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin, our guest here on Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio on this edition of Garden Talk. Visiting with Neil DeBoll, president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. And, of course, that's where they're based, but they work all over the place, don't you?
Yes, sir.
And the man's a poet, and I didn't know it.
You know, I'm not really a poet, but I'm a plant nerd, and a really good friend of mine by the name of Mike Yanni. I know many of you out there know Mike Yanni. He gives lectures mostly on trees and shrubs, and he usually will read a poem at his lectures. And he has inspired me, and I, you know, kind of dabbled around with this, but we trade poems back and forth a lot, and it's so much fun. So I woke up one morning on the morning of February 13th at 3 a.m. and this poem was going through my head, and I just went right to the computer and put it down. And it's actually a series of haikus, and I'm sure most of our listeners know that haiku is a Japanese form of simple poetry, where it's three lines, five syllables, seven syllables, and five syllables. Unless you're a
Our Vicars of Vegetables do haikus all the time.
Oh, really?
Irwin Goldman has a haiku for the beat.
They're so fun. They're so easy. Anybody can do it. Even a plant nerd like me, who's not really a poet. But I was just compelled to do this. So if you don't mind,
go ahead.
It's a series of haikus.
All right.
It's called Prairie Haiku. Mowing my big lawn seemed like the right thing to do until I woke up. I planted prairie where my lawn once used to be. Neighbors scowl at me. Prairie flowers dance, bugs and butterflies galore, avian food fest. No more mowing now. Fire purifies the prairie, jet black, so soon green. Mower rusts away, forlorn and near forgotten. Slave to lawn no more.
Oh, that's a good one. That a lot of people shaking their head, yeah, when they or nodding yes when you got in there about the lawnmower, when you got the prairie.
Hey, I hate mowing lawn, man. You know, yeah. It's like I got way better things to do.
Ron in Janesville, your turn. Hi, Ron. Thanks for calling.
Yeah. Hello, Larry. Hello, Neil.
Hi.
Hey.
Neil, I got some butterfly weed plants and some type of a blaze. I forget the name.
A blazing star?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I planted them last year in a fairly sunny spot. And, oh, boy, the butterfly weed just hung on. And I took care of it.
you watered it regularly in a horrible drought?
Yes,
yeah,
I watered it. I gave it a little mulch, maybe some allorganite, and I kept them all alive. They didn't die.
Good, good.
But when I got them, I got them on a friend's order, and I think she was contacted and asked if the soil was clay or. And she said it was a clay soil, but actually, I have a sandy soil here.
Okay.
So, does that make a difference with the butterfly weed?
Yes, it does. And actually, it works to your favor because butterfly weed generally grows best in a well-drained sandy or sandy loam.
Oh.
Although, we do have a special strain called butterfly weed for clay, which people have had very good results growing in clay. And I don't know which strain you got, but the butterfly
weed...
You got the butterfly weed for clay strain?
Clay.
Okay, that also will grow in sand and sandy loam, because I grow it at my house in my sandy loam, and it does just beautifully. So I'm going to guess here that most plants just struggled terribly last year. The fact that your plants just held on actually isn't too shabby considering the weather we had. I'm going to guess, Ron, that your plants are going to kick it up a notch this year. Now, which blazing star did you get? Do you know which one it is?
Well, the flower isn't very big, and the stalks were kind of spindly, and I actually had to use some sticks to support them.
But it actually flowered last year?
It flowered.
Wow, that's not bad considering the weather. There are blazing stars that grow in different species, grow in different conditions. For your sandy soil, normally we would recommend that you go with the rough blazing star, which is Liatris aspera, or you can also go with the meadow blazing star, Liatris ligula stylus, and there's also scaly blazing star, Liatris squarosa. Now, that's a shorter one, which only gets about 12 inches tall.
This was about 12, 13 inches tall.
Okay. Did it have a number of... Well, you only had one bloom. It's really hard to key it out.
No, it had several little ones.
Okay. That's almost certainly the scaly blazing star.
Uh-huh.
Because it tends to have more branching flowers at the base.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So, and that's normal height for it, 12, maybe 15, 16 inches.
Okay.
So, actually, if that's what you've got, it did pretty darn well, considering. And it sounds like you really took good care of them, too.
Oh, I did.
Yeah. And remember, the butterfly weed is a slow-growing perennial. It's very rare that it will bloom in the first year you install it. It usually takes 2, maybe even up to 3 years for it to reach full blooming capacity.
Mm. Okay.
There you go.
Yeah. Hey, I just want to let you guys know something, too. As we look out at the disappearing snow, I was out cross-country skiing this morning.
Well, good for you.
And it was just marvelous.
You know, it's beautiful weather this time of year. Isn't there? It's not too hot. It's not too cold. It's sunny, and there's no bugs.
And there's no bugs. That's amazing. Good for you, Ron. Thanks a lot for calling. Oh, man. And Denise in Jackson County. Hello.
Hi. I'm wondering what kind of seating I could use on an earth-sheltered home on a rolling hay field in Zone 4, and I would probably have maybe 3 to 5 feet of soil, and it's a lot of different types of silt loams, and we could amend it. And I would really like to have a wildflower mixture up there, but I'm wondering if I would also need some sort of a no-mow under that, or if that would choke it out, or just what you would think I could do there.
Okay, I'll stay on the line, Denise, because I'm going to ask you a couple questions here.
Okay.
You have 3 to 5 feet of soil on your home, not 3 to 5 inches, correct?
Yes, they're saying 3 to 5 feet to cover the... Cover it up.
Okay.
We took away the hay field, and then we're going to put it back.
Okay. And they're going to put a geotextile underneath all this, is that correct, on top of your structure?
Yes.
Okay, got it. And you have a silt loam soil?
Yes.
Okay. One thing that you want to be careful about when they, I assume that they came in and stripped the topsoil and put it in a pile, is that correct? Okay, and then they dug everything, built the house, and now they're going to put some of the subsoil back and then the topsoil on top of that, is that correct?
Correct.
Okay, is it going to be flat, sloping? What's the nature of the slope on the roof, if any?
It will become a slope going from the way that faces south towards the north, so that it will naturally drain away from the south.
Okay, so it'll be a north-facing slope?
But it will have full sun.
Okay, but how steep will the slope be on your roof? What's the pitch on that?
Is it would probably be like a regular roof, like 312.
Okay, got it, like a 4-to-1. Okay,
yeah.
Okay. You have a couple choices here. Because you have a silt loam soil, that leaves you a lot of options. You could put no-mow on there, you could put prairie on there, or you could put a combination of them. Are you gonna walk on this roof, or is it just going to be something that you seldom...
I could probably walk on it, but I prefer not to mow on it. I'd prefer to have wildflowers when I'm on the south side of the home.
Okay.
I can look back at it and see wildflowers up there possibly.
Okay. You could establish one of our prairie seed mixes on there, absolutely positively, no problem. With that kind of a rooting depth, you're in great shape. Now, we do a lot of work on green roofs, where we have to be very sensitive. Sometimes we only have 3 to 6 inches of soil to work with, and so we don't put in a lot of taprooted, if any, taprooted plants, because they need deep soil. So we have to be very specific. Because you've got 3 to 5 feet, you can grow anything up there. Taproots, fibrous roots, bulbs, whatever you want. Because it's a 4-to-1 north slope, it's going to be a little cool, but that won't preclude you from being able to establish a prairie on there. It's not too steep. You should be fine with that. And if you wanted, you could put little trails of no-mow through your prairie so you can walk through the prairie without, rustling through all the grasses and flowers. It really depends on the look and feel that you would like. Some people plant a little trail to a circle in the middle of their flowers, and they can put little chairs up there and sit on your roof among the flowers and look at the view. So there's a lot of ways
That sounds nice.
Yeah.
Where would I get this seeding, and what would it be called?
Oh, from Prairie Nursery. Hey.
All right. And I can get that through the internet.
You can get it right. Our website is www.prairienursery, and that's spelled PRAIRIE, nursery, all one word, prairienursery.com, and you can see all our products there, or you can order a catalog. Whatever you prefer. You can just go on. Easiest way is just to go online and go to the order catalog, and we'll send it off to you right away.
Yeah, and you said I could go with no-mow and a prairie seed mixture?
Yes, and we have a wide variety of mixtures. We have low-growing mixes that only get knee-high to maybe waist-high. Then we have short prairies that are more about waist-high. And then we have tall prairies that can get over your head.
Okay.
And then we have plants for our wet areas and dry areas and your soil. Your soil, by the way, as a silt loam, it would be considered a medium soil. So look at the mixes for medium soil.
Okay, very good. Thank
okay.
you so much.
You're very welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Boy, that sounds nice.
Yeah, I'd be really
sitting here thinking, boy, wouldn't it be nice to have warm weather?
It's coming.
And have the opportunity to be sitting up on the roof of your house and with wildflowers all around you and a couple of chairs.
And a beer.
And a beer.
Or
maybe
whatever.
A goat. No, you wouldn't want a goat.
No, goats would eat all the stuff. Yeah, if you just had like... We have clients who, use Arnoma on their roofs, and then they have the goat up on top of the root like they do at Al Johnson's. Not, Al Johnson's not one of them, but...
No.
But we have other clients who have done that, like tourist destinations and shops and stuff, and they put the grass roof on, and there's the goat up on top. And of course, goats eat anything.
Gene Faraca and I stood on Al Johnson's roof with the goats and had our pictures
take. It's really cool up on you. I like to go on my roof.
And actually, yeah. it is a lot. And Prairie Nursery, by the way, we have on my Facebook page, we've got a link to it, but what's the address? PrairieNursery.com, isn't it?
Yeah, www.prairienursery.com. Yep.
And that's the place to go. And the catalog is just a beautiful colored catalog with, I don't know, how many plants have you got in here?
Oh, I don't know. I didn't count them. I don't know. There's a well over 100.
There's, oh, no, yeah. There's way geez, more, way more than that.
I don't know, more than that. Yeah, we keep expanding it and, you know, new plants. And we're offering a lot more shrubs and ferns now, too. So, you know, we started off as just Prairie Nursery.
And now it's shrubs.
And then we went to, oh, people need stuff for shade. So we got woodland plants and woodland sedges. Now it's like all kinds of stuff. So it's really expanded.
Neil DeBole, our guest. Native plants add a lot of beauty and interest to a landscape, and besides that, they create a healthy habitat for all kinds of wildlife as well. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today for another edition of Garden Talk. Neil DeBole from Prairie Nursery knows a lot about native and woodland plants and grasses. Always great advice to share, whether you have a couple square feet or maybe you got acres of prairie. Neil, thanks for coming back and being with us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you, Larry. My pleasure.
We have some opportunities for you to join in as you listen. You can call us at 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or go to my Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. You can post a photo, question, or comment there. And speaking of the Facebook page, we got a really nice photo from Steve, taken at his gardens in 2011.
I think it says at our gardens, doesn't it?
Oh, that's right.
Yeah, I think he came.
Was that your garden? Yeah,
yeah. It looks like, yeah. Now, we have two nursery tours a year, the third weekend, third Saturday in June and the third Saturday in August. But he just, that was not the date. I mean, it's open. It's wide open. You can go there 6, 7 days a week. We don't care. Yeah. Come and walk the gardens. People come on Sunday and take pictures. But he's got a hummingbird moth.
Yeah.
And that is one of the coolest insects. And a lot of people think it's like a hummingbird, like a miniature hummingbird.
Yeah, because that's exactly what they look like.
And they hover just like a hummingbird. And they are what we call a diurnal moth. They come out during the daytime instead of, like most moths, that come out at night. And it's a pollinator with a proboscis similar to a hummingbird.
So it's a native pollinator.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I'm not an expert on insects, but there's two subgroups of these hawk moths, hummingbird moths, and if you look at the taxonomy of them, there's really quite amazing diversity of them. And the prairie plants are fantastic for them because they are pollinators.
Oh. And we have a lot of pollinators?
Oh, it's unbelievable. You know, the prairie is unsurpassed at attracting pollinators because you have this plethora of flowers blooming from April all the way through November in some cases. So you have this sustainable habitat that provides like a smorgasbord for pollinators throughout the growing season. And what's really interesting is with this decline, colony collapse disorder of honeybees, people are finally taking a look at native pollinators. Now, you know, honeybees are not native to North America. They're brought here for honey and for pollination.
Sure.
And we used to actually pay this guy to bring honeybees to our nursery for pollination. And then he started charging more, so we said, to heck with it. Well, we never needed it. It didn't hurt the seed production because we had all these native plants that supported healthy populations of native pollinators. And there are some native bees that are orders of magnitude more efficient at pollination than honeybees. Honeybees are not terribly efficient. And also, they require warm weather to fly. And there are a lot of bees, native bees, that fly in cold weather. So they pollinate the early season plants. Like if you go out into look at your woodland plants like hepaticas and bloodroots, you won't see honeybees on them very seldom unless it's a warm day. You'll see all these native bees and flies pollinating these plants. And people overlook the importance of flies and wasps. There are gajillions, I mean, literally thousands of species of native bees, wasps, and flies that are critical pollinators. In fact, we're working with cranberry growers in Wisconsin and Quebec to plant strips of native prairie with heavy emphasis on flowers, to provide them with year-round habitat to hold their pollinators, because they need those pollinators for the 3 weeks in summer when those cranberries are blooming.
Oh.
So they need to have those pollinators. They can't just suddenly conjure up pollinators.
Yeah.
And if they can't rely on honeybees, what they're seeing is that we have all these actually superior pollinators that we can hold on the land, and they will pollinate the plants. You know, I think something like, Larry, it's like over 30% of our crops are pollinated by insects.
Yeah.
Look, all your fruit crops.
Yeah.
All your citrus crops, all the blueberries, strawberries, all this stuff are pollinated. And if you don't have pollinators, you won't have a crop. It's a huge agricultural issue. And what people are finding is, hey, we got some really good native pollinators. If we just would create some habitat for them, they will work for us.
Very, very cool. Marion Whitewater has a question for you, and I want to turn to her. Mary, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, what's on your mind?
Well, Neil, you mentioned how the drought last summer showed that a lot of the prairie plants survived.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a list. I have your catalog, and yep. I also have a list of very low-growing, full-sun, mesic to mesic, dry and dry plants.
Yeah.
That I'm wondering, if I run them by you, if you can tell me if they did okay during the drought. I know a few of them I have in my garden, and I can water them. But if you just leave them alone,
and they
don't have any tall species around them,
mm-hmm.
are they going to survive? So I have showy wild garlic. I have Carolina anemone, pasque flower, spider milkweed, ground plum, Midland shooting star, prairie smoke, dwarf blazing star, prairie turnip, wild petunia, common blue-eyed grass and prairie blue-eyed grass, goat's rue, and kitten tails and prairie violet. And I was wondering if you can tell me that they all, in your experience, survived last summer.
Well, they all survived, but some did better than others. You know?
Okay.
Okay. If you can run through those really quick, and a couple of those, we don't grow, but run them by me real quick again, and I'll let you know.
It's a lot.
Yeah,
I'll
do it really fast. Go really, really fast.
Prairie turnip.
It was surprisingly did poorly.
Yeah.
It's a taproot. I was shocked.
Yeah. Okay. Wild petunia.
Wild petunia did great.
Okay. Common blue-eyed grass and prairie blue-eyed grass.
Did fine.
Okay. A goat's rue.
Did fine.
Prairie smoke.
Outstanding.
Okay. Dwarf blazing star.
Awesome. No problem.
That's wonderful.
Yep.
Quick.
Okay, we have
ground plum?
What's that?
Ground plum?
Ground plum, I don't know.
Okay.
Don't have
Midland shooting star. Shooting star.
That's fine because it's dormant by July and it never felt a thing.
Okay. Showy wild garlic?
I don't grow that.
Okay. Carolina anemone?
Don't grow that either.
Okay.
Well, okay. Although I'm sure it did well, and Larry's giving me the okay, let's go for a little look. So, you know, you can feel free to email me or call me at the office, and I can help you with any other questions you have. How's that?
All right. Sounds good. Thanks for calling, Mary. Kathleen and Delavan, let's go to you. Hi, Kathleen.
Hi, good morning. I'm glad to see that you are selling partridge pea seeds.
Mm-hmm.
I would recommend those to everybody for bumblebees.
Aren't they incredible?
Yes. Thousands of them.
And you know, partridge pea is an annual.
Yes.
But wild senna is a perennial.
I have that too.
And you will see the same incredible utilization. You plant wild senna, you will get bumblebees, honeybees, this bee, that bee. Bees go crazy on it. Fabulous plant.
But the partridge pea reseeds.
Oh,
it reseeds itself. So it's just kind of growing all over. But anyhow, I would recommend that to people because it's incredible. But what I wanted to ask you was you have sweet fern now.
Yes.
One of the very few nurseries that have it. In fact, I haven't seen it anyplace else.
Yeah.
I know it's not a fern.
Yeah.
But you say it's 2 to 5 feet, and other places I see 2 to 3 feet. And this is an incredible landscape plant, even though I guess it doesn't have much value for wildlife.
No, most things won't eat it because it tastes weird. You ever eat it? It doesn't taste good. I tried it.
But is it really aggressive?
You know, it creeps, but and when we put those heights on there, I mean, those are extremes.
Uh-huh.
Okay, so yeah, it will normally only get 2, maybe 3 feet. I mean, but it can get up to 5 feet under proper, you know, under optimal conditions. But
it's not going to take over everything.
No. But it does form patches.
Okay,
and it really, really does best in a light sandy soil. Not recommended for clay. Okay, and it will grow in dry sand and damp sand, but it will not grow in damp clay. That's the kiss of death for sweet fern. So keep it out of that clay soil.
Okay. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Right. Good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. And Mike in Spring Green. Hi.
Hello. Hi, guys.
What's on your mind?
Well, I recently acquired some wet mesic prairie on the banks of the Wisconsin River here by Spring Green.
Okay.
And it seems, or I'm told, that it's overgrown with reed canary grass.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't look like the beautiful Avoca prairie downstream.
Yeah.
Is there any management recommendations you'd have?
You betcha.
The quality of this?
Yeah, you got a couple options here, Mike. Number one, this is the best option. It's the most difficult, but it works great, and that is, believe it or not, burn your prairie in mid-June when the reed canary grass is in full bloom, 6 feet tall. And if you have sufficient dead grass for fuel, it will burn. It's a smoky, nasty, horrible, gnarly fire. But wow, does it work. It will knock that reed canary grass right on its hinder, and the prairie species, the sedges, the flowers will come back beautifully. If you cannot burn or don't want to burn, if your soil is dry enough by then, you can go in preferably with a flail-type mower, which mounts on the back of a tractor, and mow it right down to the dirt. And that will set back the reed canary and primarily favor the native species. It's a miraculous treatment, either burning or mowing in mid-June when the reed canary grass is in full bloom, which is its weakest point of its growth cycle. Another option, if you are willing to do this, is you can use grass-selective herbicides such as... I'm drawing a blank here. That's terrible. One's called Select. It's marketed under all sorts of different names, but there are grass selective herbicides that you can use with very, very careful timing when the reed canary is first coming up in the spring. If you do not have a lot of prairie grasses, if you have only warm season prairie grasses and not cool season, you can go in there when that reed canary is about 6 inches tall to 8 inches tall and hit it with a grass selective herbicide. Fusilade is one of those, and there's a couple others out there. So, but if you don't want to use herbicides and you can't burn it, get your mower out there in mid-June and mow that thing right down to the ground.
All right.
Okay, well, look for some big nasty smoke come mid-June.
I'll tell you what, wear your gas mask, man, or stay on the upstream of that fire because you don't want to be on...
It's nasty.
Oh, it's nasty because you're burning all that green stuff and don't inhale that. I've done it. It's not fun.
All right. There you go. Good luck, Mike. Thanks for calling. Colin in Decorah, Iowa. Hello.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
So we've got... It's a small organic farm that we're trying to manage, and it's got a series of terraces. And on each of those, we have a couple greenhouses. And in between those terraces was, up until this last winter, just gross, overgrown mess. And we had to cut most of it back to try to clear it out because it was actually shading out our greenhouses. And so now what we're sitting on is just this really kind of gross, bare dirt, really clay heavy and pretty steep. And so we're trying to figure out the best option to fill it in, make sure that A, it holds the soil in place, B, there's not a whole lot of maintenance required because it is kind of hard access because it's so steep.
Mm-hmm.
And we just want to kind of, I don't know, pick something that will thrive there, but not require a bunch of extra labor.
Okay, now this is to the side of your greenhouse, it's not between them, is that correct?
It's between, so we've got three separate terraces.
On your terraces, okay. So you have a number of these terraces.
Between the two terraces, yep.
Okay, got it. Okay, well, how far is it from the nearest greenhouse?
I'd say probably about 15 to 20 feet.
Okay, do you have permanent poly on your greenhouses? Are they Lexan? What's your greenhouse covering?
It's all 6 mil double-layer poly. It's... So it's a three-year rotation.
Three-year rotation. Okay. And when do you rotate your poly?
We'll probably be doing it next year, probably.
What time of year?
Early spring, typically.
Okay. Can you do it in mid-spring? No, you can't because you got to get it up. Okay. The reason I ask is that on a hillside like that, mowing, if you have a prairie, you have to either mow it or burn it to manage it.
Yeah.
You're not going to mow the hill, so you got to burn it.
No, parts of it could be mowed, and so we were thinking about that and the clearance as far as burning. So we were wondering about, you know, what the setback would be. But I've participated in prairie burns before, and yeah. I know the heat that comes off of them.
Yeah, you'll melt your poly, bingo. Just the radiant heat from 15 feet, you're going to have shredded poly. So you would have to burn it when your poly is down. So, okay. And you generally, in Decorah, you're going to want to burn that prairie around April 15th to April 30th. Mm-hmm. But your poly will probably be up a month before that, right?
Yeah.
Okay, that means you'll have to burn it a little early, which is not nearly as good. So your management is going to be a conflict issue. But what direction does your hillside face? That's another very important question from a microclimate standpoint.
Yeah, it's an eastern facing slope.
Okay, that's fine. You could put our normal lawn mix on it. It's not as good from a habitat standpoint. You're not going to get all the pollinators, but it's a really good problem solving product. But you won't get the flowers and the habitat. If you can mow down your prairie with a weed whacker before you burn it, you will keep the flames low to the ground, and the chance of extreme radiant heat melting your poly will be reduced. And if you take a hose and wet down your poly when you're burning it, you'll have a hose there anyway just to make sure your prairie doesn't go, you know, wrong place.
Right.
Yep. Wet down your poly, and it won't, and it should not melt.
Great.
Okay.
That's another way to do it.
There's always a trick to do it.
Okay. All right. Thanks
a lot. Good luck, Colin.
Thanks a lot for calling. And we had a question from Teresa on Facebook who wonders about planting a shoreline that gets intermittent flooding.
Do we know if it's on a lake or a stream?
Shoreline.
Shoreline, probably a lake.
Yeah, shoreline. Okay. Usually you don't say along the banks of a river.
Okay. Yes, there are some great plants for that. There are many of our wetland sedges do a great, great job of that. And so they can tolerate temporary flooding. It's hard to say which one because it will be based upon the depth of flooding and the time, the duration of the flooding.
Okay.
But one of the plants that we use in our rain gardens is called fox sedge. That was one of the plants that was surprisingly drought tolerant. We use it in our rain gardens. It's our workhorse in the rain gardens because you can put it underwater for a week in July on a big rain event, and it's like, okay, sure. And then you can go a month without rain, and it's like, oh, yeah, this is fine. So it has an incredible adaptability amplitude. So that's something we use on our shoreline restorations because of its ability to tolerate the change in moisture. Another great plant is prairie cordgrass, Spartina pectinata. This plant grows naturally in wet prairies, sloughs, edges of lakes and ponds. And what's great about it is if you really have a problem with stabilizing it, it creeps by rhizomes and it forms a dense, solid sod, and it becomes very, very erosion resistant, better than even the fox sedge. So if you have an erosion problem, put in the prairie cordgrass, put in transplants about 1 foot on center if you can afford it. Maybe if it's a big area, you might have to put them a little farther apart. And usually within about 3 years, they should creep together to form a solid sod. We use it on spillways on ponds.
Oh.
Outstanding. I mean, there is zero erosion once that's established. Really great plant. And you can add a few flowers in there, but the fox sedge does better with flowers because it forms clumps. It leaves room between them for flowers.
Yeah.
Because the prairie cordgrass forms a dense sod, sometimes it'll kind of outcompete the flowers. So if you want flowers, you might want to go with the fox sedge.
Marilyn in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello. What an exciting show. I've had a prairie here for about 20 years, and I know, Neil, you said that it should be burned or mowed, and I've been burning usually in March, you know, before all the snow is gone. But I've got this thing, like sometimes I've had like 50 pounds of lupins here. And now it started out totally bare on the sand, and now I have so many oak trees that it's just like it's itching to be a forest. I thought it was going to be a savanna, but it's just like so many black oaks.
Yep.
And a friend of mine in Madison that I sell some lupins to for restoration, he said I should get them before they're too big and use this particular type of poison and just, you know, do a cut. Stump treatment on it.
Yep, absolutely right.
I just wanted to see what you think about that. I mean, I thought, you know, I could just let some of it turn into forest, of course.
Sure.
And then see where I've got the real thick, because the lupins are kind of moving around.
Yeah, they do that. Do you know why they move around, Marilyn?
No, I don't.
Have you seen how their seeds ripen? Have you ever gone and collected their seeds?
Oh, I do it all the time, every year.
Okay, and when you're out there, what sound do you hear?
Well, the popping, and then they fly around.
Yes,
and
they fly 15, 20, 30 feet. They eject their seeds, and that's why they're moving around. But as far as lupin is actually a savanna plant as well as a prairie plant. It grows on dry, sandy soils only. It will tolerate, if you get less than a half a day of full sun, you will start to see a decline in the flower production of lupine. So if you want to maintain the lupine, you've got to thin out those trees so that you have enough sun to really get good production of flowers and seeds. And to kill black oak or pretty much any of our woody, deciduous trees, shrubs, buckthorn, honeysuckle, whatever your target is, you need to cut the tree in the fall or winter before the sap starts to come up in the spring. And then cut it all the way to the ground and then apply an appropriate herbicide to the cambium just inside the bark, the first half inch inside the bark. The interior of that tree is dead. There's no vascular tissue to transport the herbicide down to the root, so you only need to put it on the very inside half inch inside from the bark. I used to use expensive Garlon, which costs like $75 a gallon or more, and I just got, I ran out of money, so I went and just used Roundup, and now you can get Roundup or glyphosate. You don't have to buy it from Monsanto. A lot of people hate Monsanto, and for understandable reasons, but you can get it for like $18 a gallon. It used to be like $80 a gallon like Garlon, and just apply that in an undiluted 40% solution. Some people will dilute it to 20%. I just keep it at 40, and I drip it on, just a drip, 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 so there's very, very small amount going into the environment. I do this anywhere between October and March, end of March usually. And I get 99.99% kill. And you don't have to dig up those black oak. Sorry?
Oh, I bought a little quart of something special that he told me about that I have Roundup.
Yeah.
That leads me to another thing. Can you let those things freeze, like Roundup and things like that? I mean, they don't freeze, but I keep them in this shed that isn't warm.
Some herbicides, if you freeze them, they will be rendered useless. Read the label. And this is the most important thing. If you're using herbicides, read the entire label. Read all of the safety hazards, what you need to wear, how to use it. It's absolutely essential because you can take in herbicides through your eyes, through your skin, through your mouth. There's all sorts of ways. And your skin is the most common way that people get poisoned by herbicides. So you want to be really super careful and read the label, read the label, read the label.
And unfortunately, those labels usually are small type, and there's a lot of information.
A lot of information.
A lot of information there, and your eyes start to glaze over after you're straining your eyes to read it, and then... So sometimes it's even better if you're online to go online and read the label.
you can Google it. You can just Google it and say, glyphosate, or take the name of the herbicide and then say herbicide label, and it should come up.
Yeah, and it's a lot easier to do it.
Yeah, but that you'll have good results with that, and that should take out your black oaks instead of trying to dig a 10-foot deep root out.
Neil, always a pleasure. Time flew.
Hey, it always does, Larry. We need to do this for another 3 hours, but I think people have other things to do.
Neil DeBoer, our guest, who is president of Prairie Nursery in Westfield, Wisconsin. We have it's prairienursery.com is his site. You can go there and order a copy of, if you'd like, of their of his catalog. It's a wonderful catalog and something you may want to take a look at. It's great to have him along, and we'll have him back for sure. And Monday, boy, the weather guys come by. Steve Ackerman, John Martin will come by to talk about the cold end of March. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
WPR's spring sweepstakes are on, and you could win airline tickets, an iPad, a gas grill, or this year's WPR artist mug. To enter, just make a donation by May 15th. If you're a sustaining member, you're automatically entered. To find more information, including how to enter by sending in a postcard, go to WPR.org. Good luck in our spring sweepstakes.